Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a podcast which throughout 2020 has featured some of the world's leading thinkers looking in depth at the implications of COVID for Australia, the region and the world. My name is Alex Oliver and I'm the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. This is the last COVIDcast episode of 2020 and in fact the final episode of COVIDcast as we reach the end of this year of the pandemic and hopefully start 2021 with a brighter outlook as the world emerges from the worst stages of the virus. In early 2021, we'll be launching a new podcast, Lowy Institute Conversations, in which we'll continue our series of fascinating discussions between our Lowy Institute experts and the world's best thinkers on international relations, foreign policy, and global geopolitics. But before I hand over to my colleagues for this final episode, I wanted to quickly recap some of the extraordinary conversations we've had since the pandemic emerged in early 2020. We started the pandemic year as we're finishing it, with a conversation in early March, before the virus was officially declared a pandemic, between some of our most senior experts, chaired by our Executive Director, Dr. Michael Fullilove, with Senior Fellow on China, Richard McGregor, our Southeast Asia Program Director, Ben Bland, and Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Director Natasha Kassam. They looked at the global response to the coronavirus as the full implications of the crisis were beginning to take shape. I chaired a discussion a couple of weeks later with Richard McGregor on China's response to the pandemic, and another with two of Australia's leading Pacific analysts and Lowy Institute experts, Jonathan Pryke and Shane McLeod, on the pandemic in the Pacific Islands region. Our lead economist, Roland Raja, had conversations with some of the world's most eminent economists, including Council on Foreign Relations Senior Fellow Brad Setzer, Columbia University Professor Adam Tooze, Pascal Lamy, the former Director General of the World Trade Organization, talking about the future of globalization, and Dr. Adam Posen, head of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, talking about America's economy. Natasha Kassam discussed the pressures on the World Health Organization in the early stages of COVID with Joel Nagin, and later interviewed Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu. Roland Raja talked with Rachel Ziemba from the Center for the New American Security and our Middle East expert Roger Shanahan about the oil price collapse. Hervé Lemieux discussed global geopolitics with former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and talked with Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs Senator Penny Wong about Australia's role in a post-COVID world. Jonathan Pryke talked with the rising star of the Australian Parliament, Dave Sharma MP, on Australia's Pacific relationship. He also had a conversation with Secretary-General of the Pacific Islands Forum, Dame Meg Taylor. Richard McGregor talked with the New York Times China correspondent Chris Buckley after his working visa was revoked by the Chinese government. He also spoke with author and leading China journalist Dexter Roberts. Sam Roggeveen talked with Professor Hugh White on the virus's impact on the power balance in Asia. Ben Scott talked with Lowy Institute non-resident fellow Bobo Low about the pandemic and the role of China and Russia in shaking up the global order. Economist and Pacific specialist Alex Dayon interviewed Greek Member of Parliament and former Minister of Finance Professor Yanis Varoufakis. He also spoke with Nobel laureate and former World Bank Chief Economist Joseph Stiglitz. Richard McGregor had a series of conversations about China's wolf warrior diplomacy with Bilahari Kausikan, Yun Sun and Shivshankar Menon. Research fellow Lydia Khalil talked with former White House Coronavirus Task Force member Olivia Troy. Ben Bland sat down with former Indonesian Finance Minister Khatib Basri. Today, our final COVIDcast episode, Director of our International Security Program, Sam Roggeveen, who founded the Institute's Interpreter magazine, will wrap up the 2020 COVIDcast series in a discussion about the impact of the pandemic on power and geopolitics in the Indo-Pacific. He'll be talking with Director of our Power and Diplomacy Program and author of the Asia Power Index, Hervé Lemieux, together with one of our newest economists, Alyssa Leng, who's looking at the changing distribution of economic power in the region. I hope you've enjoyed COVIDcast and I look forward to many more fascinating conversations with some of the world's most brilliant thinkers next year on Lowy Institute Conversations. Sam, Hervé and Alyssa, over to you.
Thanks, Alex. I'm Sam Roggeveen, Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. In this, the final edition of COVIDcast, I want to introduce you to the 2020 Lowy Institute Asia Power Index. The 2020 edition of the Power Index, which covers 3 years of data, is the most comprehensive assessment of the changing distribution of power in Asia so far. The Asia Power Index ranks 26 countries and territories in terms of their capacity to shape their external environment. You can find the Power Index at power.lowyinstitute.org. It really is an indispensable research tool for the study of power in all its facets in Asia. This year, the index includes some new indicators, one of which is the perceptions of international and domestic handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll come to that theme in a moment. For now, my job is to introduce you to the two experts who are responsible for the Asia Power Index and who will be my guests today. Hervé Lemayeur is director of the Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute and the driving force behind the Asia Power Index. Hervé joined Lowy from the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. And Alyssa Leng is a research associate in the Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute. Alyssa previously worked at the Australian Treasury and the Reserve Bank of Australia. In a moment, we'll talk with our two guests about COVID and how it has affected the distribution of power in Asia. First, Hervé, to you. To set the scene, can you give us some brief highlights of this year's Power Index?
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for the kind introduction. We have conducted this exercise 3 years now, so we're getting a better sense of the trends over time. Obviously, the pandemic has played a key role this year, but in many ways, what we're seeing is an acceleration of history rather than a disruption in the trends observed so far. And one way you could phrase it is that this year has really set in motion a race to the bottom among countries competing by degrees of underperformance. And no country has registered a greater fall in its overall standing, its prestige, and its power than the United States. U.S. standing has waned in all but one of eight of the core measures of power. So we look at everything from military capability to cultural influence. China, though, has not emerged in better shape. Its power has stalled. It, like the United States, has emerged diplomatically diminished from this pandemic. And in fact, none of the top four players, if you look at Japan and India, which are ranked third and fourth in the index, have done well. They've all either stayed where they are or have fallen further behind. And the only three countries that were the exception to this rule of 18 countries falling further behind to where they were, more vulnerable as a result of a more unstable region and the economic fallout of the pandemic. The only exceptions to that rule were three middle powers, very diverse and differently placed in the ranking. There's Australia, which has now become the sixth most powerful country, surpassing South Korea. There is Vietnam, which is 1 point short of Indonesia now, ranked 12th overall. And there is Taiwan, which falls further behind, still quite vulnerable, but has also done rather well out of this year. So that is really sort of a very long story cut very short in terms of the overall findings.
Well, let's dig down a little bit, Hervé, just on the US-China contest for power in particular, which dominates our region. What has COVID done to the dynamic between the United States and China?
Well, obviously very divergent national responses between China and the United States. And I think this has really sharpened the contrasts and narrowed the power differential between the two standout players, the two superpowers in our region. More than that, I think great power politics, as well as the virus itself, is now contributing to what I would call a regional bipolar disorder. So we can't really talk about a unipolar moment anymore. You can't really talk about the US as being the standout power. I think it's far more correct to describe the region in which we function as a bipolar Indo-Pacific. And what you have is stark strengths and weaknesses on both sides. So the US is still well ahead of China in terms of its military capability, in terms of the defense networks that it has accrued over multiple decades, even in terms of its cultural influence in our region. If you think about cultural goods and exports as a way of influencing the minds of shaping other countries and other people in terms of wanting what you want, the classical definition of soft power. But the US has fallen further behind China in measures where Beijing is already ahead, notably in terms of economic diplomacy, in terms of economic capability as well, and in terms of actually widening the gap, diplomatic influence, even though China has had a difficult year. The US has lost more overall prestige than China has as a result of its bungled domestic response. Now, China is guilty of that in different respects, but at least its performance legitimacy is intact as a result of ruthlessly suppressing the virus domestically.
Now, Hervé, just one quick follow-up to that. I notice you didn't use the term multipolar to describe the order that's emerging in Asia. I suspect that's deliberate.
Yeah, I think if you look at the index and the distribution of power as it stands today, it's very hard to conclude that we live in a truly multipolar world where multiple countries fall within about 80% of each other overall power. But one way of talking about this is I don't think we're necessarily emerging or re-emerging into a new Cold War between the United States and China, at least defined in the sense of mutually exclusive spheres of influence. Interdependence continues in our region, despite the US and China becoming less dependent on each other. Everyone else is still engaging with US and China in various respects. You're not going to have alignment with US and China across the board. Third players, smaller players will choose to exercise their agencies in different ways and align themselves with US and China on issues rather than exclusively and ideologically. And I think what that means is that perhaps what we can describe this region as more appropriately is a form of asymmetric multipolarity, where the choices and the interests and the actions of smaller players will become more consequential in a situation where neither the United States nor China can really assert undisputed primacy, and when, in fact, both have emerged rather diminished and polarizing out of this crisis.
So, Alyssa, let me turn to you now and ask you specifically about the major powers in Asia and how they've done substantively and reputationally over this last year of COVID.
Thanks, Sam. So in terms of the two superpowers in our region, the US and China, they've had quite different responses to the virus and have been perceived in different ways across the region. So the US in the index this year was rated as having the worst domestic response to the COVID-19 pandemic, whereas China was rated as having an above average response. But despite this, both countries suffered reputational hits as a result of how they've dealt with the pandemic at home, but the US much more so than China, suffering the biggest damage to the reputation. Other major players have sort of bounced around. India struggling both reputationally and in terms of their handling at home, but Japan doing reasonably well, much better than average. It's actually been quite interesting. It's been the non-traditional and the smaller players in our region that have actually emerged the best on the health front of the virus. Those players including Taiwan, New Zealand, Vietnam, and they've been rewarded for that on the international stage as well in terms of their prestige.
So let me dig down a little bit with you on India, because I think the result from the power index this year shows that COVID is going to have quite stark long-term effects on India's growth trajectory, particularly relative to China.
That's right. So India is projected to suffer quite a large economic hit this year. I think it's somewhere in the magnitude of about a 10% contraction. And that hit is going to stay with it for some time, sort of denting the hopes that that many around the region have that India will be able to rise and sort of compete with China in terms of at least economic size. So on our forecasts, it looks as if India is going to be about 13% smaller by the end of the decade compared to what we thought before, and also about 40% the size of China at the end of the decade rather than 50%, meaning that the difference between the two players is going to continue to be quite large in the economic realm for some time, and the degree of convergence will take longer to occur.
Which I guess reinforces Hervé's point about a bipolar balance of power in Asia rather than multipolarity. But Alyssa, let me just ask you a bit further about some of those smaller players. You said that their reputations had been enhanced. So how does the power index measure that kind of thing? How do we know that they're doing better now reputationally than they were 9 months ago?
Yeah, so to drill down into this, we actually spoke to and surveyed a number of experts across the region, both in foreign policy community as well as in the medical and epidemiological fields, to sort of understand what people thought of countries' domestic response to the virus, how that played off internationally, as well as their contribution to multilateral attempts to work against the virus. So it was a combination of those things.
I mean, I think, Sam, it's also a powerful reminder, the pandemic, that legitimacy and leadership on the world stage often begins at home with the capacity of leaders to govern well domestically, and the interlinkages between domestic performance and international performance, I think, are quite stark, particularly in the US case. I mean, obviously, the US has, under the Trump administration, also been quite a problematic player this year internationally. It's withdrawn from the World Health Organization. But if the result in the US had been a bit more competent at coming to grips with the virus, we may not have seen that kind of fall in US prestige.
And so would we expect then that there'll be some recovery in that number? I mean, a lot of the advances that we've seen over the last few months with regards to a vaccine are centered on the United States, right?
Absolutely. And so this is the point. This is a snapshot in time. We obviously published just before the US election. This is a dynamic situation, and reputations change very quickly sometimes. And a vaccine diplomacy is a very live issue. But just over the weekend, we saw the rollout of the first kind of installments of Chinese vaccines in Indonesia, for example. So this is, multiple actors competing here. And what's interesting is it's not just the US and China competing on the science behind the vaccines, but an array of smaller players as well in Europe and the UK, even, Belgium, which is producing some of the vaccines which are required for the UK. But Australia as well has a role to play in terms of being potentially one of the first countries to onshore manufacturing of the vaccine. So we could play a very constructive role in Southeast Asia, but all depends on our willingness to do so and how quickly we can mobilize on the ground. So that will be the big story, certainly in the first 6 months of next year.
So Hervé, we're moving around a little bit, but I do want to take you back to the US-China contest for power in Asia. Just what you've learned over the last 12 months and the data that you've collected now. As I said at the in the introduction, we now have 3 years' data to work from, and we do have also now a year of pandemic where we've learned an awful lot about the relative strengths and weaknesses of these two great powers. So what can we say now about the rate of change in that great power contest? What do we know now that we didn't know, for instance, 3 years ago when you began this project?
Look, we knew what the power differential was between the US and China when we first did this exercise in 2018. It was about 10 points on a 100-point scale. But what we didn't know was how quickly China was closing the gap with US. And normally power shifts happen only slowly outside of wartime. We're talking about something that usually takes decades to materialize. But what has been particularly dramatic is the way in which China, in the space of 2 years, has now narrowed by half the power differential between itself and the US. So it's down to about 5 points. And that's just in the 3 years that we've been conducting this exercise. So the rate of change, not just the change itself, matters. I think it also engenders all manner of instability and potential miscalculation, fear and hubris on the part of the US and China, respectively. And in a similar way to the global financial crisis in the last decade, really was a catalyzer, an accelerator of the pace of change in the global redistribution of power between US and China. I think the pandemic will have a similar effect, and certainly that appears to be the case in terms of our forecasting. The world, or the distribution of economic power between US and China prior to the pandemic, was that at market exchange rates, China was about two-thirds of US economic output. By 2025, the IMF expects China to have reached 90% of US economic output at market exchange rates. At purchasing power parity, China is already well ahead. And that suggests to me that that leveling, that point of convergence between US and China will occur under the most likely scenarios, probably within this decade, probably towards the end of this decade. The big question is, how do those two superpowers function? How do they react to that? How do they miscalculate potentially? How do the others in the region react to that? Because the momentum, China has the narrative of momentum on its side, whereas the US has inertia, which is much harder to kind of bill as a strength. But the point is that, what the index does so well is to show both the strengths and weaknesses of China. The fact that China is catching up in terms of its military capability, it has invested in weaponry that now undeniably can threaten US and allied bases in the region. At the same time, it lags far behind in terms of defense networks, and that really remains an Achilles heel, so long as about 11 neighbors of China continue to have unresolved boundary disputes or interstate legacies of conflict with China that continues to poison the way in which China is perceived in this region. So the ability for China to simply replace the US as a security guarantor, or to steal the scepter of unipolarity from the United States, I think that is not there. And whilst we can talk about a leveling, I don't think we can talk about China replacing the US. And there's another reason for that, and that is simply that beyond 2030, demographic aging in China really accelerates, And there are a number of other variables we can go into. But suffice to say, I think beyond this decade, which will be very tumultuous, I think we can expect a bit more stability in the distribution of power between the US and China.
So I'm really pleased you mentioned demographics, because it leads into my next question. I would just be interested to ask both of you, actually, about what working on this power index has done to your thinking about leadership. So an awful lot of time has been devoted this year to the US presidential election. But when you consider how baked in some of these trends are, not just demographics, although that's a major one, but also the big economic factors that take years, decades to really develop. You talked about military capabilities as well. You know, the military capabilities these days take sometimes multiple decades to really develop. I mean, if you look at Australia's own submarine project, for instance, it's like a 30-year project. So as you've worked on this this project where you do focus on those long-term trends, what has it caused you to think about individual leadership? Have you become a bit of a determinist that leadership doesn't matter so much anymore? Does the shift from Trump to Biden, for instance, in the United States, is that going to significantly move any of these big trends that you've been talking about? Hervé, I'll start with you.
I've really put your finger on it, which is it's the age-old tension between kind of the structural forces that we're looking at and the political choices and the relative weight of that. And look, we make a very core distinction in our methodology between what countries have in terms of their capabilities and what countries choose to do with what they have in terms of their level of strategic ambition, their degree to which they want to exercise network power, even the geopolitical objectives they set themselves, which vary country by country. The reality is it's always a combination of both those things. Will the US election make an impact? I think so, perhaps not as much as some hope, however. I think that a lot of the reasons for which we've seen the US decline in this region over the past 4 years come down to not just a relative decline, structurally speaking, in relation to the size of China's market size, but also to the political choices made by a Trump administration in terms of its unipolarity. So yes, I think we can, but probably not as far as some would like. I would also point to Indonesia as another counterexample. I mean, in Australia, we always look at Indonesia either with fear or with hope, given that it's such a large neighbor of ours, that it ought to be a great power at some point, you know, within our lives. And the fact is, we're just not really seeing that materialize. So population in itself is a necessary but not sufficient criteria for doing well. And in fact, if you look at Indonesia's economic forecast, so translating that demographic dividend, it's probably still bouncing along between 10 to 15% of Chinese output for the next half century. So it's going to stay exactly where it is. The same Indonesia we know today will continue in more, you know, more than likely to be Indonesia of tomorrow. And on top of that, look at President Jokowi. You know, he follows in a long line of leaders that tends to be more inward looking, prioritizes domestic priorities over the international. And so, yes, I think it's a combination of the structural and the political.
So, Alyssa, I guess from your perspective, as you've looked at the performance of Asian countries on COVID over the last, 9 to 12 months, you would regard individual leadership as being a major determinant of success or failure?
I don't know if I call it the... I think it's important, but I wouldn't call it the major influencer. I think the way I kind of think of it is that you have this massive power on the fundamentals of which are, you know, the size of your economy, your military capability, so on and so forth. And while leadership can change the direction in which you steer these things, as Hervé was alluding to, leadership can't substantially or quickly at least change the fundamentals themselves. They can change them in the long run, but not in the short run. So I think leadership has the ability to you can wield what you have for better or worse, but you can't substantially change the fundamentals of your power quickly. Coming back to the point about the US also, I think there is definitely scope for the leadership change in the US to have an impact on the region. But I think it's just important to caveat and think about that Joe Biden is going to have to deal with the shadow of the past, both the past legacy of the Trump administration in its sort of knee-jerk reactions and how it's changed its approach in the region, as well as the shadow of the Obama administration, especially in light of some of the choices that Joe Biden has made in his appointments. So I think leadership, of course, has a role to play, but I think it's constrained by a lot of structural factors.
I'd be interested to know from each of you whether you'd be willing to take a bit of a stab now at what you'll be saying in an interview like this in 12 months' time about Asian power, and particularly about, I guess, what we'll then be calling the early recovery phase from COVID. Alyssa, do you want to take this one on first?
I think if we're talking about recovery, we'll see that there's definitely an advantage that will have accrued to China by that point by starting its economic recovery quicker than pretty much anyone else in the region and also avoiding a degree of permanent damage. But also you'll see, I think, different rates of recovery come playing out across the region where a lot of developing countries will manage to get back on their feet relative to where they are in 2019 quicker. Which I think will have quite interesting consequences on the balance of economic power, at least in the region. So I think that would be something to watch out for.
Hervé?
I'm not sure I can add very much to that. This year has obviously been a very big one. It's always a difficult assessment to make in the throes of a crisis. Hopefully by next year, we'll have a clearer sense of just how pivotal the pandemic was in changing the longer term variables in the distribution of power. My sense is at the end of the beginning, in terms of the knock-on consequences, the health pandemic may have abated by the end of next year. But if you look at military spending trends, which depend on revenues from governments accrued from taxes, which depend on the vitality of economies, you know, all those sorts of secondary consequences actually only start flowing in a year, 2 years, 3 years on from the pandemic. So we've only begun to see what the long-term changes are as a result of COVID-19.
Hervé, Alyssa, thanks both for joining me for today's conversation.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Sam. Always a pleasure.
As Alex Oliver said at the beginning of this podcast, this is the last episode of the COVIDcast series, and we look forward to joining you next year with the new Lowy Institute Conversations podcast. I'd like to thank my colleague Jennifer Reinhardt for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels and stay up to date with the latest policy developments on the Lowy Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thanks for listening. Season's greetings to you all, and stay well.